This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello and happy Saturday, everybody, and welcome to the reading of the Jefferson and Franklin County News, brought to you every week by Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Our first stories this week come from the Jefferson County Leader, and the edition is dated April 11th. And on the front page, the top story, True Crime Junkies. I don't know about you, but my wife, for sure, is a true crime junkie. She watches all that stuff on TV. I don't know if she listens to podcasts, but she definitely watches a lot of true crime TV. And I'm betting if any of the guys out there, your wives are that way too, they love that stuff. So this one is about some local women. County women turned interest into podcast. When Jefferson County residents Jennifer Flanders and Camille Anderson started their weekly true crime podcast nearly 6 years ago, they decided to focus on bizarre, lesser-known cases. They said they started the podcast called Our True Crime Podcast on July 11, 2018, and since then have produced 344 episodes and garnered nearly 6 million downloads. That's incredible. Episodes are recorded on Sundays, and a new episode is released every Wednesday at 4 p.m. The show is available on any podcast platform. The two podcasters say they hope listeners feel they are having coffee with friends. Anderson and Flanders have been best friends since the sixth grade. They grew up in Union, and life brought each other to Jefferson County. Anderson, 54, lives in Crystal City. She's a mother of two children, ages 19 and 21, and is a language arts teacher at Seckman High School in Imperial. Flanders, 54, lives in Imperial. She's a stay-at-home mom of two children, ages 15 and 18. How it began. Anderson and Flanders said they've always enjoyed watching horror movies and shows like Unsolved Mysteries, Dateline, and 48 Hours. Flanders remembers them watching the Helter Skelter movie during their first sleepover. In 2017, Flanders sent Anderson information about the crime convention, and Anderson surprised her with tickets. There, they met true crime television personalities like Nancy Grace and spoke to podcasting pioneers. On the drive home from Indianapolis, Anderson tried to convince Flanders they needed to start a true crime podcast. A year later, Flanders was ready. When they ordered the podcasting equipment, they had no idea how to set up audio or edit it, Flanders said. They didn't even know what the buttons on the equipment did, but they dove in head first, she said. When the two finished that first episode, they thought they knocked it out of the park, but have since changed their minds, Anderson said. It's so difficult to hear that first episode, she said. The first few episodes were pretty rough. Their voices were at different volumes, and they seemed to be fighting each other to get a word in, they said. Flanders said podcasting turned out to be a lot harder and time-consuming than they originally thought. 6 months in, after a lot of tears, they realized they needed an editor and hired Nico Vatisse, who edits their podcast from Scotland, of all places. Narrator Edward October reads their viewer discretion warning at the beginning of the podcast, and Loretta Allen, a published author from St. Louis, helps as a writer and researcher. Flanders said it's been a long road, but a worthwhile one. Anderson said she and Flanders have met a lot of people from all over the world, adding that they have many fans in Australia and the United Kingdom. Flanders said the podcast brings in some revenue, including some from ads the two read on the show, adding that we do okay. Anderson said she'd love to see the podcast regularly get millions and millions of downloads and bring in enough money so she could retire from teaching and work on the show full time, adding that getting nearly 6 million downloads since the podcast start is pretty good for two little Jefferson County girls who knew nothing about podcasting when they started. Flanders said when the podcast began, they opted against just offering up goofy entertainment and instead agreed to focus on advocacy, making it more about the victims than the criminals. She said it's important to remember they're talking about a family's worst day. Anderson said nothing is more rewarding than having a family member reach out to them and thank them for their work on an episode. She said listeners have asked if they're worried about running out of podcast ideas. Sadly, Anderson added there's no shortage of true crime cases. Flanders and Anderson take turns researching and presenting information about the case for a podcast, with the other woman hearing the information for the first time and reacting and responding to it. So the reactions are genuine, Anderson said, recalling Flanders' case about a young Australian couple lost in the woods where she couldn't get over the end. So far, the two have never tried to research the same case. We have a running document of over 400 cases that we found on our own or had requests to do, Anderson said. She said sometimes when they're researching a case, they stumble onto a more interesting one. The women said they spend anywhere from 6 to 20 hours investigating one case. They are partial to looking into cases with ties to Missouri, but they do report on cases from all over the world. Episode 9, Deathbed Confession, Gina Brooks' Angie Houseman Connection, focuses on the 1993 murder of 9-year-old Houseman of St. Anne before her killer was caught in June of 2019, and the unsolved 1989 disappearance of 12-year-old Brooks of Fredericktown. Episode 125, The Chief, the Gym Rat, and the Hitman, is about William Pagano, who served as Festus' police chief from 1974 to 1984 and killed himself after he was convicted of murdering Mark Timothy Todd. Every year at Christmas, we do the 12 Nightmares Before Christmas, Flanders said. Starting on December 13th, we post an episode every day like an advent calendar. We've been doing it since the beginning of the podcast, and it's very popular with our listeners. The women said there is no cursing on the show, and they try to avoid going overboard on gruesome descriptions. Speculations are not our thing, Flanders said, adding they rely on police reports in their research. We try not to give our theories. They are looking forward to their Dark History UK tour from June 13th through 22nd that will take them to Edinburgh, York, and London. Flanders said 15 people have booked the tour, which includes airfare and hotels, and 3 are from Australia. For more information, visit the Our True Crime Podcast Facebook page or ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Now, I'm going to send this to my wife so she can start listening to it. Next from the front page comes from Rock Township Ambulance District. Digging in. Joint Ambulance Sheriff Project to break ground today. The Rock Township Ambulance District and the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office will hold a groundbreaking ceremony at 6 p.m. on April 11th at the site of their new shared facility on Lions Den Road west of Old Lemay Ferry Road in Imperial. The event is free and open to the public. The 6.4-acre property, which the Ambulance District purchased for $260,000 in 2022, will house a combined ambulance station and sheriff's office substation. Construction is estimated to take about 12 to 15 months, Rock Township Chief Jerry Appleton said. The plan includes 14,569 square feet of total space, with about 7683 on our side and 4680 on the sheriff's side, Appleton said. The other 2,000 square feet will be shared space. Costs for the $7.75 million construction project will be shared between the two entities. Engineering and architectural services will be split down the middle, and construction costs will be divided according to how much space each entity is allotted, with Rock paying just more than 60%. We are continually working with our design team and contractors to offer additional savings through value engineering, Appleton said. That could total up to an additional $130,000 in savings. The ambulance district's share of the cost will be funded with revenue from a $23 million bond issue voters approved in 2018, Appleton said, and the county's share of the construction costs will be drawn from sheriff's office reserves, Sheriff Dave Marshak said. Once the building is complete, the county will enter into a long-term lease agreement with Rock Ambulance for the sheriff's office portion of the facility. Rock Township currently operates 4 stations, and a 5th has long been part of the district's long-range plan. The new house will be smack dab in the middle of the district, so we'll be able to reduce response times, Appleton said. The sheriff's office has been looking to relocate its East Zone substation, which has been housed on the Windsor C1 School District campus in Imperial for more than 20 years. We've had a really good relationship with Windsor, Marshak said, but the space we're occupying now was not designed to how we want to use the substation. We've been putting money aside to get this done for some time. Preliminary plans call for the sheriff's office substation to be open from 8 to 4, with Rock Township ambulance crews present in the building around the clock. We will immediately staff with a 24-hour advanced life support unit, Appleton said, and will house our shift battalion chief since it's at the center of the district and make him respond quickly from there to anywhere they are needed. And here's a story about senior expo in DeSoto and also a calendar of all the senior expos that are coming up in the next 6 months or so. About 400 people turned out for a morning of fun and learning at the DeSoto Senior Center Expo on April 3rd. The expo, held at the Knights of Columbus Hall in DeSoto, was the first of six that Leader Publications will hold this year for people 50 years and older. About 30 vendors were on hand for the DeSoto Expo to talk about a variety of goods and services of interest to seniors. Many of the vendors offered drawings for prizes. It was a great senior expo, said Caitlin Mary Skaggs, digital marketing manager for Leader Publications. We were excited to see all the seniors out and about. Gene Boyer of Imperial won the drawing for Leader's grand prize package, two third-row tickets to Spotlight Theater's upcoming performance of Oklahoma, along with dinner for two at Tetro's Bar and Bistro in Festus. Boyer said she loves going to the Senior Expo events. I love the bingo, the music, and all the things they give away and the information, she said. Courtney Wisely and Kayleen Brooke of the Spotlight Community Theater were at the expo to present information about this year's show and how people can get involved in the nonprofit group's mission to offer Jefferson County residents arts and arts education. They talked about all the work they do, Skaggs said. Kayleen, who was one of the Dorothys in The Wizard of Oz, which the Spotlight group put on last year, performed Somewhere Over the Rainbow. It was an absolute treat. She is very talented. Don Ficken with the Missouri Eclipse Task Force spoke at the event about the phenomenon, and the St. Louis Astronomical Society handed out eclipse glasses so people could view it safely. Party Paws Mobile Zoo brought four animals for seniors to look at, to touch and hold if they were brave enough. Featured were Rocky, a Eurasian eagle owl, which is a picture of him, he's beautiful, Cricket, a barn owl, Godiva, an IMG red-tailed boa, and Bruno Sumatran, an Argentine red-tailed boa. I assume they mean boa constrictors, as in snakes, so no thank you. In addition to vendors and speakers, free donuts and coffee were served. Two 30-minute sessions of bingo were held with several prizes, including restaurant gift cards. As always, the expo event wrapped up with music by J.B. Lewis and the Legends Band. Skaggs said she's excited for the next Senior Expo, which will be the Leader's first ever South County Senior Expo to be held next month. The following expos are planned from 8 until noon on Wednesdays. May 1st is South County Senior Expo at the Kennedy Recreation Center, 6050 Wells Road. June 26th is Festus Senior Expo at the Festus R6 Performing Arts Center. July 24th, Westside Senior Expo at Northwest High School in Cedar Hill. August 21st, Arnold Senior Expo at the Arnold Eagles Hall. And October 16th, Eureka Senior Expo at the Timbers of Eureka. Businesses and organizations interested in securing a vendor space for any or all the events may contact the Leader at 636-931-7560, or you can email them at ads@leaderpublications.biz, and biz is spelled with a Z. Let me give you those dates one more time. South County Senior Expo on May 1st, Festus Senior Expo on June 26th, July 24th, the Westside Senior Expo, August 21st, Arnold Senior Expo, and Eureka Senior Expo on October 16th. If you have questions, call the Leader at 636-931-7560. Well, here is a bizarre story, tragic story, about a former sheriff's office deputy whose trial is getting set to be brought to trial in December. A December jury trial has been set for former Jefferson County Sheriff's Office deputy Colby McCreary, who pleaded not guilty to driving while intoxicated during a fatal one-vehicle crash on I-55 in Festus on April 30th, 2023. His wife, Savannah, died following the crash. McCreary, 30, of DeSoto, originally was charged with one count of DWI resulting in the death of another and first-degree involuntary manslaughter, each one a Class C felony punishable by 3 to 10 years in prison. In January, however, the Jefferson County Prosecuting Attorney's Office announced it had amended the charges against McCreary, and he now faces a Class B misdemeanor DWI charge that carries a penalty of up to 6 months in jail and a possible fine of up to $1,000. As part of that announcement, prosecuting attorney Tricia Stefanski said after prosecutors received findings from a crash reconstruction report, they felt there was a reasonable doubt as to whether Colby McCreary committed the offenses with which he was originally charged, so the charges were reduced. Our office will continue to pursue the charges that are supported by the evidence, she said. During a March 28th hearing in the case, a jury trial was scheduled for December 5th and 6th in front of Jefferson County Division 12 Associate Circuit Judge Tony Mananzella. Also on March 28th, a hearing was set for November 7th in Division 12 to hear a motion to suppress. Typically, a motion to suppress is filed to call into question a piece of evidence in an effort to prevent it from being used in a case. Festus Police conducted the initial crash investigation, and then the Missouri Highway Patrol took it over. The original criminal charges were filed against Colby McCreary on June 6, 2023. After that, the Highway Patrol completed a full crash reconstruction report, and according to the prosecuting attorney's office, that report showed the following, which is, like I said, very bizarre. Neither person in the vehicle was wearing a seatbelt. A passenger in a second vehicle that had been traveling near the McCreary vehicle indicated Savannah McCreary had put her butt in the window as they passed the McCreary vehicle just before the crash. Prior to the crash, the right front passenger seat occupant size classification, registered as child and given Savannah McCreary's actual weight, indicates she was not falling in her seat in the 5 seconds before the crash. The vehicle was traveling at 86 miles an hour prior to the crash and was traveling at 74 miles an hour at the time of impact, with the speed slowing 1.3 seconds before impact. The vehicle was traveling straight down the interstate until 1.8 seconds before impact, when the wheel was abruptly turned in a clockwise direction. This caused the vehicle to veer to the right. It's unknown what led to this turn of the steering wheel. The shift lever was in drive position until 1.5 seconds before impact, when it was moved to the left, which occurred just after the steering wheel was abruptly turned. The abrupt turn of the steering wheel could have been caused by an unrestrained passenger to come into contact with the shifter, causing it to move to the left. Then at 1.1 seconds before impact, the wheel was turned counterclockwise. The vehicle's rate of spinning then slowed as the driver appeared to countersteer just before the impact. The vehicle ran off the right side of the road, crossed a ditch, ran into a small rock bluff, then overturned. Both occupants of the vehicle were ejected. Savannah McCreary's lower body was exposed. Once the abrupt steering occurred, it was not possible for the driver to regain control of the vehicle before it impacted the bluff. There was no evidence of mechanical failure or roadway issues that contributed to the crash. According to previous reports, Colby McCreary was driving a 2015 Jeep Cherokee on southbound I-55 near the 177-mile marker at 1:05 a.m. April 30th, and the vehicle ran off the right side of the road and hit a rock bluff, and the vehicle overturned, ejecting him and Savannah McCreary, who died at the hospital following the crash. She was 28 and left behind 2 young children. Colby McCreary was injured in the crash. While the Missouri State Highway Patrol often handles accidents along the interstate, especially serious ones, Festus Police worked the crash involving the McCrearys. More than a week after the crash, Festus Police Chief Doug Wendell asked the Highway Patrol to complete a follow-up investigation, Corporal Dallas Thompson of the Highway Patrol said on May 17th. According to the report from that Highway Patrol investigation, a toxicology report showed McCreary's blood alcohol content was 0.17%, more than twice the legal limit in Missouri, which is 0.08%. Based on the report taken from the hospital where he was taken after the crash, he was diagnosed with alcohol intoxication, the Highway Patrol said in its report. Colby McCreary is the son of DeSoto Police Chief Jeff McCreary. Well, we finally have a resolution in Herculaneum. Mayor breaks the tie. After two votes, Herculaneum finally has a new city administrator. Herculaneum Mayor Ryan Wright cast the tie-breaking fourth vote on April 1st to hire Dusty Hosna to be the town's next city administrator. Board of Aldermen members Chris Baker and Norm Seifel, both of Ward 2, and Israel Klayman of Ward 3 also voted to hire Hosna. Ward 1 Aldermen Mike Burledge and Dennis Tezru, and Ward 3's Edwin Edwards voted against the hire. It was the second time Wright, who had recommended Hosna for the job, asked the board to vote to give him the job. The first vote on March 4th was deadlocked in a 3-3 tie, and Wright did not vote to break it because the city attorney advised him that he wasn't allowed to. After that meeting, however, Wright learned he could have voted, so he planned on March 18th to again ask for board approval to hire Hosna, but Burledge and Edwards were absent, so the issue was tabled. After Hosna was hired on April 1st, he started the job the next day, replacing city administrator Jim Kasten, who retired on March 26th after 16 years in the role. Hosna, 38, will be paid a $90,000 annual salary. Kasten was earning $82,000 a year when he left. Wright said Herculaneum received applications from about 20 and 25 people for the job. He narrowed the field to 6 applicants for interviews in front of a 6-member selection committee that included Wright, Kasten, one alderman from each of the city's 3 wards, and a member of the city's employee review board. Wright said Hosna was the committee's highest-ranked candidate after the first round of interviews, and the top 3 candidates went in front of the full board of aldermen for another round of interviews. Typically for that type of job, applicants would interview in front of the city employees review board, but Wright said he had not appointed anyone to that employee review board, so he wanted to create his own selection committee that included aldermen. The board hadn't been used in years, and I didn't know anybody on that board, and I wanted to bring people from the actual board of aldermen on my selection committee. At the end of the day, the board of aldermen has the final say. Those who voted against hiring Hosna said they believed another candidate was better qualified. Wright, on the other hand, said he believes Hosna was better suited for the job because he has more than 10 years of experience in municipal government work and has been an assistant to the city administrator in North St. Louis County, a city clerk for Brentwood, and a city administrator for Valley Park before his most recent job as the economic development director for the village of Fox Lake, Illinois. Hosna said he studied public policy at the University of Illinois in Springfield, but did not obtain a degree. He said he's also taken several courses in economic development through the University of Missouri St. Louis and through the International Code Council and is working on receiving his American Institute of Certified Planners certification. Some of Hosna's duties will include overseeing the city's daily activities, serving as chief liaison to the mayor and council, preparing agenda and materials for the Board of Aldermen meetings, overseeing the city's economic development activities and promoting the city to future developers, assuming budget responsibility for all city departments, handling all public relations for the city, overseeing the bidding process and contracts for all city projects, overseeing all personnel functions for the city, including hiring and firing, and ensuring compliance with local, state, and federal job law. And man, this is a big job. There's a lot of responsibilities there. Hosna lives in DuPont, Illinois with his wife Brittany and 2 children, Emma, 5, and Stanley, 4. He said he's excited to get to know Herculaneum. I would say the thing that stuck out about Herculaneum is its location right off the highway, he said. It's a mix of business and residential and has the potential for development in the future. Hosna said he's a certified drone pilot and plans to use his drone to take videos of the city. I'm working with the park superintendent who does our social media, and we definitely plan, as things start to bloom and look great, to really show everyone how beautiful Herculaneum is. Hosna said he wants to be involved in the community and expects to participate in park cleanup days and the upcoming Arbor Day celebration, which is set for 10 a.m. on April 25th at Herculaneum City Park. I truly am very approachable and easy to talk to, and if anybody wants to come up to City Hall and talk, I am always available, Hosna said. So congratulations to Dusty Hosna, third time's a charm, and now he is the new Herculaneum City Administrator. And this next item is the opinion page from the Jefferson County Leader. This one was written by Goldie Lowe, and it's in honor of the most recent election that had a miserable turnout of less than 10% of registered voters. Want your voice to be heard? Try showing up. I see it all the time. A city council, a school board, or county council has made a decision and people are mad. Comments on social media are full of anger, vitriol, and finger-pointing about how this decision could have possibly been made. Why didn't they do that? Insert some idea, often a wacky, illegal, or wildly impractical option. Then the accusations start. They're all corrupt. I wonder how much money they got paid to do that. It's because they're buddies with so-and-so. And then the biggest complaint, why didn't I get a vote on that? When do I get my say? Well, I hate to break it to you, but you did get your say. When your city council member or school board member has run unopposed for the last three elections and you didn't care to run or volunteer or donate to anyone else's campaign, your non-participation said, I agree with whatever the incumbent chooses to do. A person on an elected board recently told me that because their board hadn't had any contested races for years, it was a sign to them that people were very happy with what they were doing. Although it's a sad sentiment, it's hard to argue with that logic. These members typically get paid very little, usually a couple hundred dollars a month, if anything at all. It's certainly not enough to be considered a money-making venture, especially given the time commitment a lot of them assume. I understand that running for a board isn't for everyone. Many people can't make the time commitment. Others have too much anxiety to be in the public eye. I understand that. Luckily, there are other ways to make your voice heard, such as, oh, I don't know, voting? When it was time for school board elections, city council elections, mayoral elections, county council elections, and you didn't show up to vote, participation in the April 24 election was a measly 9.7% in Jefferson County. Your decision to stay at home said, I don't care who represents me or what they do. For shame. For shame to the people of Jefferson County for only having less than 10% of you come out to vote in an election. That's just awful. Another way to participate is by attending meetings. All these publicly elected boards are required to post their agendas, and most do so online. I've never had trouble finding any of those agendas, and as part of my job, that's something I do quite often. For big decisions, changes usually do not happen over one meeting. There's a step-by-step process that occurs over the course of several meetings, if not months. These boards are not hiding anything from the public simply because the public chooses not to look. I've gone to many of these types of meetings in my role as a reporter, and for almost every meeting, there are usually fewer than three residents in attendance in a town of thousands. At plenty of meetings, I was the only person in the audience. When you don't attend the meetings, your non-attendance says, I don't care what's decided in these meetings. I get it. Those meetings are typically very dry and boring. A lot of times, not much seems to happen. However, they are a great opportunity to make your voice heard. Most public bodies provide opportunities for public comments if you want to let them know your thoughts. Your city's website most likely has your council person's phone number and email address readily available. When you didn't make a public comment about a concern and didn't contact your council person or school board member about a topic of interest, your silence says, I have no concerns and agree with whatever you choose to do. Another way to participate is simply by staying informed. When big changes are coming, typically the leader runs stories about them. Do you read these stories to find out what's coming up, or do you skip them because it's not something that interests you? Online, we can see which stories readers are clicking on to read. I haven't seen many weeks where reporting on the actions of the board or council have taken up any of the most popular slots. Such stories typically don't even crack the top 10. Another avenue to make your voice heard is in the paper itself. The leader allows readers to submit letters to the editor, see the facing page, to share their opinions on various topics. I can't tell you how delighted I'd be to see letters coming in on a topic other than Trump versus Biden or whatever national controversy has people riled up this week. But sadly, the number of letters we get on local topics is low. There are so many opportunities for residents to make their voices heard, and for the vast majority of people, they are choosing not to do so until either the very last meeting before the final vote or after the ink has dried and it's all said and done. Suddenly, they're very interested and are outraged they haven't been personally asked for their opinion. I don't know if they expect every issue to come up for a public vote instead of being handled by their board or council. If that was the case, there wouldn't be much need for a board or council. We'd just publicly vote on every topic. But given the abysmal voter turnout on the elections we do have, I can't imagine turnout would be any better if voting on issues large and small took place every month. There are mechanisms for the public to make their voices heard, but making angry comments after the fact on a city's or school district's or local newspaper's Facebook page isn't a particularly effective one. I've been somewhat interested in being a poll worker for a couple of years now. I mean, who wouldn't jump at the chance to work a 14-plus hour day for a whopping $125? I sent in the paperwork to become a poll worker just a few weeks ago, and when I tell you that I got a call almost immediately, I am not joking. I guess volunteering to be a poll worker is even less popular than voting itself. I was asked to work on the recent April 2nd election. Let me tell you what I learned between 6 a.m. and 7 p.m. that day. Most people do not care. Of the registered voters who did show up, I would guess that probably at least 80% of those voters were over the age of 65. If as many people showed up to the polls as complained about the results of the elections on social media, they might actually get what they want. Just food for thought. One of my favorite sayings, I don't know who said it first, but I always repeat it, is don't bitch if you don't vote. And that is exactly what Goldie Lowe is saying here. Don't bitch if you don't vote. There are so many opportunities to have your voice heard. You just have to get out there and do it. And so please take to heart what was said here in this very well-written opinion page on a very important topic. It's not all about Trump versus Biden. There are thousands of other things going on in this country on a local level that the local boards and commissions would beg for you to be a participant, to show up, to vote in every election, to call your city alderman or councilman. You know, just get involved. Get involved first by just registering to vote. That is a simple thing to do. And if I remember right, there's a lot more people who are not registered to vote than those who are. So please register to vote. Vote in every election and have your voice heard. And now we're going to turn our attention to Franklin County and the E-Missourian. And our first story comes from East Central College. Big news out there. $5.5 million grant will fund respiratory care at East Central College. East Central College will spearhead a new respiratory care program in conjunction with four other community colleges across the state, funded by a multi-million-dollar federal grant, according to officials. Dr. Robin Walter, ECC Vice President of Academic Affairs, announced Thursday that the U.S. Department of Labor has committed a total of $5.5 million over the next 4 years to the initiative. The grant, which the department awards to programs aimed at creating sustainable economic growth in rural economies, includes funding for new staff positions at ECC and the construction of a full respiratory care lab at the Union campus. The college led the grant writing process and will serve as the main overseer of a program that will reach 70 primarily rural and low-income Missouri counties, according to officials. We're responsible for administering the grant and really ultimately responsible for the accountability of the program, Walter said in an interview. We're the lead, for lack of a better word. Walter said the grant will help Missouri students train and hopefully work closer to home. If they train locally, they're more likely to get adapted and accepted into a hospital in that area, she said. The five community colleges that applied for this grant together, Moberly Area Community College, North Central Missouri Community College, State Fair Community College, and Three Rivers College and ECC, will pool their students in a consortium model that is already in use for other healthcare programs. Walter said the schools collaborate on a medical lab technician program based in Moberly and an occupational therapist assistant program based in Sedalia. We don't have enough students in our smaller region to support a program. It would cost the taxpayers more money. It's not sustainable, Walter explained. What we've done to be sustainable is that in this consortium, we each contribute students. The consortium meets regularly to discuss curriculum and school needs, according to Walter, and the idea for a respiratory care program has been under discussion for over a year. Walter said healthcare providers in rural communities across the state have made their needs known. We know from our partners that they need respiratory care. We hear that loud and clear, and we hear that in terms of the metrics, in terms of the vacancy rates of those positions. And my four counterparts have the same story, she said. Amber Pataki is the manager of respiratory care services at Mercy Washington. She said she and her coworkers function as a care team that takes care of the whole hospital, providing services from the childbirth center to the emergency room. I think COVID really shined a light on the importance of respiratory therapists, she said. But Pataki said that just like in other branches of healthcare, staffing struggles have hit her department in recent years. During the height of the pandemic, she said Mercy Washington had difficulty finding even contract staff, not to mention full-time employees for respiratory care. She said it remains a battle to meet the growing needs of the expanding hospital. We have a very small group, and it's hard whenever someone retires or moves away or whatnot. It's hard to fill that position, she said. Pataki said she believes the move from ECC and other schools will help local opportunities for respiratory care to just keep growing and growing. Walter said the grant will cover several staff positions, including a director of the new program, a full-time faculty member to supervise clinical work, and some adjunct faculty. In addition, the grant will foot the bill for student expenses, including travel and technology. As well as the lab in Union, the grant will fund the construction of another lab in Columbia for students further west. Walter said equipment costs were one of the biggest financial barriers for the consortium when first considering adding respiratory care. It's really expensive to start a healthcare program. It's expensive to purchase equipment. I mean, you're purchasing ventilators for a lab, and hospitals can barely afford that, she said. Walter said that since economic development is the impetus for the program, it will emphasize workplace experience through internships and apprenticeships. Funding from the grant begins on May 1st, and Walter said the consortium will get to work right away with getting program leadership in place. Schools plan to begin offering respiratory classes by the fall of 2025. Our next story has to do with the upcoming election in November. Challengers outraise incumbents in Missouri races for Senate and 1st Congressional District. With one seat in Congress up for grabs, an incumbent facing a serious challenge, and a former publisher and media personality taking on a longtime office holder, this year's federal elections in Missouri promise an interesting summer and fall. Add to that the U.S. Senate race, where both likely fall contenders have more money already than almost every other candidate running statewide. In the 3rd Congressional District, where Republican incumbent U.S. Representative Blaine Lueckemeyer is not seeking re-election, and the 1st District, where Democratic incumbent U.S. Representative Cori Bush is being challenged by St. Louis County Prosecutor Wesley Bell, the key battle will be the August 6th primary. Both districts were drawn by lawmakers to be safe seats for the party in power. In the 2nd Congressional District, solidly Republican rural counties were added by lawmakers to shore up the GOP's chances to keep it. Republican U.S. Representative Ann Wagner and Democratic candidate Ray Hartman, founder of the Riverfront Times, are the likely nominees for a fall matchup. In the Senate race, Lucas Kuntz, who lost the 2022 Democratic primary in the contest ultimately won by Republican Eric Schmidt, is hoping to unseat U.S. Senator Josh Hawley, a Republican hoping to secure a second term. Campaign disclosure reports that were due Monday at the Federal Election Commission are the first indication of which contenders are ready to fund to run full-scale campaigns. And for Hawley and Bush, their challengers managed to outraise them in the first quarter of the year. Hawley's campaign committee took in $1.9 million from January to April and about $600,000 more than his expenses, and leaving his cash on hand on March 31st with $5.4 million. Kuntz's campaign raised $2.3 million, spent $1.2 million, and reported $3.3 million in the bank. More than $1 million of the amount reported by Hawley's campaign was a transfer from the Hawley Victory Committee, a joint fundraising PAC that raised a total of $1.5 million in the quarter. In a news release about his fundraising, Kuntz said he feels momentum behind his campaign because he has regularly raised more than Hawley over the past year. Since last year, we've built a worker-led, people-powered, record-breaking coalition to win this race and take this U.S. Senate back for everyday people in Missouri, Kuntz said in his release. To get to the fall election, Kuntz must defeat three primary opponents, including State Senator Carla May of St. Louis, who reportedly raised $9,136 in the quarter and has a total of $6,300 in the bank. The other two primary candidates are December Harmon of Columbia and Mita Biswas of St. Louis. Harmon reported raising $344 in the quarter and had $1,969 on hand. In the first district, which includes St. Louis and much of St. Louis County, Bell entered the race to unseat Bush after flirting with a bid for U.S. Senate. Bell, elected to his current post in 2018, raised $960,000 in the first quarter of the year, outpacing Bush and amassing a big lead of cash on hand. Bush, who is seeking her third term, raised $495,000 in the quarter. She reported $215,000 in the bank compared to $1.1 million for Bell. Bush and Bell are both in office because of successful primary challenges to incumbents. Bell defeated longtime prosecutor Bob McCulloch in 2018, while Bush defeated U.S. Representative Lacey Clay in the 2020 Democratic primary. Bush easily defeated State Senator Steve Roberts in the 2022 primary on her way to winning a second term. The 3rd District, which runs through all or part of 16 counties from Lake of the Ozarks to the Mississippi River, is the only Missouri congressional seat certain to change hands this year. There is an 8-candidate GOP primary, but only 3 of those candidates, former state senators Bob Onder and Kurt Schaefer and State Representative Justin Hicks, filed disclosure reports with the FEC. That means the other candidates have raised minimal amounts and have no report due. On the strength of a $500,000 personal donation, Onder has a big early fundraising lead. His campaign took in $700,000 during the quarter, spent $7,000, and reported $693,000 on hand. Schaefer raised $118,000, spent $7,000, and reported $111,000 on hand. Hicks, a first-time lawmaker, raised $45,000, spent $3,400, and had $42,000 remaining. Other candidates in the Republican primary are Arnie C. Deinhoff of O'Fallon, a perennial candidate, Chad Bicknell of O'Fallon, who lost a primary to Luke Kamire in 2018, Kyle Bone of DeSoto, who lost a 2018 primary for a Missouri House seat, Brandon Wilkerson of Fenton, who lost to Luke Kamire in 2022 and 2020, and Bruce Bowman, a Jefferson City businessman. 2 Democrats, Bethany Mann of Wentzville and Andrew Daly of Fulton, have also filed, as has Libertarian Jordan Roden of Vienna. In the 2nd District, Harden entered the race in mid-March and raised $23,000 by the end of the month. After spending $3,000, he had $20,000 on hand. Wagner, who is seeking her 7th term, raised $428,000 and had $2.8 million in the bank at the end of the quarter. So, as usual, elections are about a lot of things, but right at the top of the list is how much money they raise. Speaking of raising money, this one's for a really good cause as opposed to elections. Union Class breaks record for Humane Society donation. Each year, Jennifer Moore's Project 180 classes at Union High School collect donations for the Franklin County Humane Society. This year, the 70 students over 6 classes shattered their old record. They collected over $8,300 worth of items like blankets, towels, and kennels, pet food, and cleaning supplies for the Humane Society to use. Moore started collecting for the shelter before she was a classroom teacher and brought the idea to St. Clair and then to Union. The previous record for Moore's classes was 4,300 in St. Clair and 3,000 during her time in Union. Junior Ivy Stoddard brought in more than $600 in items on her own. She collects items throughout the year for the drive. Like many who see animals in a shelter, Stoddard wants to adopt every pet she sees. While she can't do that, she does the next best thing, collecting items to assist animals at the shelter until they find a permanent home. "I love helping," she said. "It makes me happy. I like to see people at the animal shelter realize everything."